It is a profound synchronicity that on this day or night in Tiruvannamalai, in Tamil Nadu, within the nation that now refers to itself again after thousands of years as Bharat, but not yet Mahabharat. Today on the holy mountain of Arunachala, or in the night, the great bonfire of Shiva is lit. It's lit every year, but it is a symbol of that which happens only once in the kalpa of time. And because the year is a time cycle in miniature, it can be modeled within that frame of reference. But that is the physical lighting of a bonfire. That itself is only the symbol of what must happen in this Arunachala, which is the lighting of the bonfire of the vanities, the lighting of all that is vain within the consciousness and is not the ego pure vanity or impure vanity. And based on fantasies and wishful thinking and illusions and arrogance and greed and attachment and all of the vain and in vain attempts of the ego to find happiness in a realm that has no essence and therefore its lack can never be filled. And so it's that vain effort from the wrong level of consciousness to regain the freedom, the majesty of the eternal flame that must now be lit in the only way it is possible to be lit, which is to surrender one's heart, one's mind, and one's body entirely to the service of God. And of course it is this that the ego refuses to do or is ignorant of its possibility. You know, it's very interesting. The great German philosopher, Peter Sloterdijk, whom you now have all been introduced to, he gained his fame in one of his early books, maybe it was his first, called The Critique of Cynical Reason, in which he was able to describe very accurately how the collective consciousness in the modern and, of course, worse, in the postmodern period has been indoctrinated into cynicism, a cynicism that rejects truth. It rejects the reality and even the possibility of truth with a capital T. And it rejects the possibility of God. It rejects the possibility of spirit. It rejects the possibility of transcendence. And it rejects surrender most of all, even if it has some theoretical construct that is theistic, but the actuality of surrender cannot be attained because it's embedded in the programming of the cynical ego that it must never surrender its pseudo-autonomy to another. This is what in the modern period is idealized as individualism. And the whole process of therapy, including that of Jungian therapy, has been taken in by this ideal of individuation. When the whole problem is that the individual ego, which is a completely fabricated delusion in the first place and is pinned to an identification with a mortal body and a very limited capacity for autonomy and independence, is given the task of never being vulnerable to the influence of an other who might be able to offer wisdom and a path out of the labyrinth of illusion, because it puts one in a state of dependence. And so the ego remains with this pseudo-independence that refuses to make any commitment to an apprenticeship to a higher understanding that can be in such unconditional devotion that it can tolerate the hacking away of its ego illusion that it clings to so tenaciously. And because it refuses to bear any pain caused by another, it will not undergo the surgery that is required for the egoectomy that must be gained in order to create the space for the grace of God to enter into the consciousness. And then, you know, in Sloterdijk's magnum opus, which is a trilogy of three gigantic books, that are interestingly titled Bubbles, Globes, and Foam is the last one. And he very interestingly analyzes the history of the transition from the ancient to the medieval to the modern period, as it is called, since the conventional history does not include earlier yugas. And he postulates that in the ancient world, we lived within a single global consciousness because everyone recognized the reality of that we were created by the mind of God and still and always within the mind of God, that is the ultimate globe or hypersphere in which our existence manifests. But then in the middle period, especially it happened collectively in the West during that period that is known now as the Renaissance, but with the birth of science via Galileo, Copernicus, and that group, and the burning at the stake of Giordano Bruno, on the other hand, created the path of objective scientism as the progressive form of humanistic development. And in this situation, the individual became the empirical judge of the criteria of truth. And so the world broke up into bubbles. But those bubbles depended on objective confirmation of whatever realities one considered to be valid. And that objective field of agreement, collective agreement, became a bubble. It's no longer within the field of cosmic reality, which is now an open-ended infinite space that's uncontained by the presence of God or goodness or providence, and we are ruled by chance in this doctrine. And then the bubble, which of course depends upon collective agreement and of a necessity of a meeting of the minds, soon became impossible because of the various different systems of belief that that began to unfold as science itself broke up into differential disciplines that no longer communicated fully with each other, as now we see that biology doesn't really communicate with quantum physics, nor with chemistry, and certainly none of them with psychology, nor psychology with theology. So we have this consciousness now in which the bubble has popped, and there is no longer a grand narrative that can hold the world together. This was the announcement of François Lyotard in the his book on the postmodern period. And then finally, as Sloterdijk says, now we have all been reduced to tiny foam particles, and everyone has their own truth, their own approach to reality, their own gender, their own antagonisms, their own attempts to create some kind of a coherent sense of the world and of who they are. But there is no longer any cultural agreement that holds the center together. No center that holds the periphery together. But it's very interesting that it's in this period in which the collapse of consciousness into not only external fragmentation, but an internal foam of within the ego itself, which has broken up into conflicting drives and attitudes and superego demands and projections that can never sustain any coherent object constancy or subject constancy. And so there is always an internal vibratory oscillation, a struggle that is going on, because the subconscious no longer communicates with the conscious, and the conscious no longer has a clue about accessing the superconscious. And the capacity of the mind to comprehend and therefore be in equanimity and stability and an appreciation of the developmental thrust that is occurring both within and without at a level that is beyond the autonomous desire or capacity to grasp of the ego mind leaves it out of sync with the real. And so its imaginary constructs can no longer cover over what is accelerating and morphing too quickly to be able to veil in its monstrous and groundless revelation of the unthinkable, the horrific, the too awful to think could ever have happened, and the mode of unfoldment within the sphere of disinformation of the media and the appropriate cynicism even of all of the alternative voices that create simply a chaos of different paranoid conspiracy theories, but offer nothing for the consciousness to be able to make use of in order to function with absolute karmic accuracy. It's this situation in which, in the total darkening of consciousness, the grace of God is simultaneously being revealed. The original yogis, in some myths, the Adi Yogi was Dakshinamurti, and in other myths with other names, usually this being is either a docetic apparition of Shiva or a human embodiment or a being possessed by Shiva consciousness. But that absolute presence within the original yogis, let's put it in the plural, were conveyed entirely in silence. There were no teachings. Yoga was never a system of doctrine or a belief or even of practice. You know, religion became a set of practices, whether ritualistic or somatic or mental, but the act of Sat Yoga is not actually a practice, but the realization through the flatlining of the ego consciousness of the presence that is always already complete, full, and absolutely mature in its consciousness of the absolute truth of what is happening and what is in the virtual and the non-existent levels of the real that are the sources of the unfoldment of what seems to be phenomenally occurring. And so it was in the transmission via silence that yoga was propagated. But a time came when, because of the ego mind having been captured by language, that internal silence was no longer possible for most people. The mental chatter for most does not end, or if it ends, it's momentarily, and then it returns in order for you to tell everyone what a wonderful meditation you had, but now it's lost, and the mind is back in its vanity of wanting to describe its attainments. And so the consciousness, because it cannot, it has no more mastery over its own mind, it cannot bring about the stillness necessary for the realization of the Absolute Self. And so this became, therefore, the prompt for creating philosophies of yoga. And there were different schools of them, and they gradually broke apart into Vedanta and Shaivite and various Buddhist schools of yoga and Taoist yoga, etc. But they were all attempts to accomplish the same goal. And in the Buddhist construct, at least in, let's say, Tantric Buddhism of Tibet and later of China, the first turning of the wheel produced the recognition that the world and the ego mind is the cause of suffering. And to be free of that, it must empty out of its craving for gratification that is temporary, rather than turning to that bliss that is never lost, But the Buddhists frame this in a negative mode in which nirvana is the blowing out of the flame. But the ego is not the flame. The ego is the veil over the flame. And then the second turning of the wheel, therefore, what they had to propose was the emptiness. This is the shunyata doctrine, the first doctrine. The emptiness of the world. Everything in the world is empty of swabhava, empty of essence, empty of inherent reality, because it's just made of what we would now say are temporarily collapsed quantum and qualium wave functions. But they will not last, and those wave functions will disappear again into the ocean of consciousness, and nothing will manifest until another collapse of the waves that is brought about by consciousness, ultimately by the ocean of consciousness itself, not by beings within it. However, once the world is manifest as a field that is a dream within the mind of God, then the beings who are deputized to have dreams within the dream, whether on the soul level or the ego level, create a great fractal panorama of levels of consciousness within this spectrum. And once that is understood, one has the ability then to enter the next emptiness, the shunya, which is the emptiness of thought, of otherness, of duality. And it's that emptiness that is also the fullness. But one can understand this philosophically and still have no access to it practically. And so long as the mental chatter remains as an obstacle, and of course the chatter produces emotions, fear, and all of the panoply of shame, guilt, and all of the negative feelings, including anger and hatred, etc., that keep the ego heart from opening in a state of total unconditional love. And it's only in the state of love that the chatter stops. Because when you see a being, why do they say when you see someone who is drop dead gorgeous, right? Because love is usually at the ego level a function of attraction to a form. Not at the soul level, which is attraction to the beauty of consciousness, but at that level, what happens? One is stunned into at least momentary silence, but it's the momentary silence of awe at the beauty of anything, whether it's a sunrise or a bonfire on the holy mountain or some kind of a natural environment that is sublime, awesome, otherworldly, that one sees with new eyes that are totally present, or it's something that is so totally uncanny that one cannot conceptualize what one is confronting. It's in those moments that the mind stops. And so when we realize that we are receiving the grace of God, it's in that moment that the mind stops. When you are receiving it, because it's awesome, it's uncanny, it's inconceivable, and the fact that it's real, and that all the cynicism of the ego was never true, and it all shatters and collapses instantaneously. All the belief systems of the ego are realized in the moment of receiving grace that they were all delusions. and narcissistic vanity. And when one receives that grace that lights up, which is why we're in the Festival of Lights period of the year, lights up the soul, then the question is, can you sustain that state of grace? It's given by God to one who is open to receiving it, which means one must be in a state of surrender. That's the first obstacle. But the second obstacle, once the grace is actually received, is sustaining it, not returning to the mental chatter. And this requires that the grace will have dissolved the ego's attachment to language as the source of its power. No ego wants to be left out of the ability to think, even though it's thinking that has created the problem, which cannot be solved by thinking itself. Thinking is the problem, and thinking cannot solve the problem. But the mind is indoctrinated into believing that your power of thinking is the only real weapon you have. I can think for myself, right? And it's that one will not give up in order to receive the mind of God. And so this is where humility is essential on the spiritual journey, if one is going to overcome this final obstacle. And it's then, ironically and paradoxically both, that the final step of non-duality into the non-duality of non-conceptualization and that of concepts is attained. Because now it's the mind of God that is functioning, no longer the ego or even the soul's dream level of or thread of consciousness through space-time, but the mind of the whole, of the absolute. In its unity and non-duality of essence and energy, of thought and presence, is attained. And it's attained as a state of ultimate blissful union of love, in which your own mind is finally able to feel and become one with the mind and the heart of God. And this is the act of Satyoga. May this great act be attained on this beautiful day of the lighting of the fire of Shiva on the holy mountain of God. May you know the peace that will fill you in real one when you regain your complete wildness, your dropping of the domestication of the ego, and the return to the true self-sovereignty of the uncreated self. And know the peace of being free of the influence of the dualistic delusion. May you know the deeper peace of real two when the heart has opened humbly to receive the love and the presence of God. and know that nothing else is needed or wanted. Nothing else could possibly be desired beyond this. So that the heart is forever at peace. And may you know that supreme shanti, which is the eternal stillness and the infinite potency of the intelligent, blissful, luminous power of God that abides always on the throne of absolute consciousness and is never any other than yourself.